Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to Tuesday. This is DW's Africa Link coming to you live from Bonn in Germany. My name is Abubakar Jallo.
And I am your co-host Ole Tengen Jr. with What's Trending on Social Media.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, a woman is now the second most powerful person in the history of the Gambia. But how controversial is the country's newly appointed vice president?
The 1997 constitution of the Gambia has said that whoever is 65 years old, he or she cannot be president. And the same law applies to the vice president. And the vice president who has been appointed yesterday is 68 years old.
And Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is on a three-nation tour in Africa to seek trade and also action against the network of an exiled cleric, Fethullah Gulen.
Turkey aims to upgrade its trade and commercial relations with the African countries because Africa is among target markets for Turkish enterprises.
And I will be bringing you some of your comments on the situation in the Gambia.
These stories are more coming up shortly, but first a look at what's happening around the world.
I'm Christina Kripal with the DW News. Great Britain's Supreme Court today ruled that the government cannot trigger Article 50 to leave the European Union without an Act of Parliament. Supreme Court President David Neuberger explained why.
When the UK withdraws from the EU treaties, a source of UK law will be cut off. Further, certain rights enjoyed by UK citizens will be changed. Therefore, the government cannot trigger Article 50 without Parliament authorising that course.
The government of Prime Minister Theresa May had appealed a similar earlier ruling by a lower court. Supreme Court President Neuberger made clear that the ruling did not affect Brexit itself, which resulted from a popular referendum on EU membership last June. Russia, Iran and Turkey announced today that a new trilateral mechanism will monitor and ensure full compliance with the ceasefire in place in Syria since late December. After 2 days of negotiations in the Kazakh capital of Astana, they also agreed on full access for humanitarian aid. German Economics Minister Sigmar Gabriel, leader of the Social Democratic Party SPD, today proposed that former President of the European Parliament Martin Schulz should run against Conservative Chancellor Angela Merkel in September 24th general election. He said Schulz had a better chance than himself of winning the race. Gabriel also relinquished the party leadership. He will succeed his party colleague Frank-Walter Steinmeier as foreign minister when the latter becomes president on February the 12th. The SPD is in a tripartite coalition with conservative parties CDU and CSU, which has governed Germany since 2013. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. Gambia's new president, Adama Barrow, has appointed 68-year-old Fatoumata Jallow Tambajang as vice president. The nomination is controversial because the constitution sets an age limit of 65 for the position. Tambajang used to be an ally of former President Yahya Jammeh, but had to flee the country after they fell out. Less controversial is her call for Jammeh to be prosecuted for crimes committed during his rule, Gambian journalist Omar Wali told DW.
If you talk to most Gambians, they will tell you whether she said it or not, Jammeh should face prosecution because he spent nearly 22 years in power and a lot has happened during that time. And Jammeh should face justice for some of the human rights violations.
Meanwhile, President Barrow is still in Senegal with no date set for his return to Gambia. More than 7 million people are threatened by hunger in areas of West Africa formerly controlled by the jihadist terror militia Boko Haram. Most have to subsist on one meal a day, the United Nations announced on Tuesday. 500,000 children in the region are so malnourished that their lives could be in danger. Toby Lanza, UN's humanitarian coordinator for the region, said urgent help is needed for the people whose full extent of suffering was made clear only after the terrorists were driven from the area. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Christina Kripal.
I am Abubakar Jallo. It's confirmed that the new vice president of the Gambia will be a female and also from the opposition coalition that helped bring new President Adama Barrow to power. The appointment of Fatoumata Jallow Tambajang as vice president was announced at a news conference late Monday by coalition spokesman Khalifa Sallah. Salah also said that the rest of Barrow's cabinet will be revealed later today. President Barrow, who is still in Senegal, said the appointment was designed to address Gambia's gender imbalance. Gambian journalist Omar Wali joins me now on the line from Banjul. Omar, how controversial is the appointment of the new vice president?
Well, the controversy surrounding her appointment is that the 1997 constitution of the Gambia has said that whoever is 65 years old, he or she cannot be president. And the same law applies to the vice president, because when the president is not there, the vice president automatically takes over. And the vice president designate, or the vice president who has been appointed yesterday, is 68 years old. That is the controversy at the moment.
Apart from that controversy regarding her age, Fatoumata Tamanja had said now exiled President Yahya Jammeh will be prosecuted. Her announcement was what led Jammeh to renounce the outcome of the election. What do Gambians think about her?
If you talk to most Gambians, they will tell you whether she said it or not, Jammeh should face prosecution, because he spent nearly 22 years in power and a lot has happened during that time. And Jammeh should face justice for some of the human rights violations. And most of them are against the statement, but some are in support of it, because Jammeh has been in power and a lot had happened that left a bad taste in many mouths.
Does her appointment as vice president needs to be confirmed by a parliament, or is it a final decision?
This is a final decision. It doesn't need to be confirmed by the parliament. President Barrow has appointed her as the vice president. This is the system you have here. The president will appoint the vice president, compared with other West African states.
Okay. Now, Umar, speaking about the parliament there, how soon will they convene for the very first time?
Well, their time will end in April this year. But at the moment, as we speak now, they are working on the table resolution to revoke the state of emergency, which was imposed by Yahya Jammeh a few days ago before he left the country.
President Lamar Barrow is still in Senegal and hasn't set any date aside to return to Banjul. What do you think is responsible for the delay?
Well, there are many factors. One is security reasons, because the spokesperson for the coalition, Khalifa Salah, has said that the state house, presidential palace, need to be sanitized first, because they don't know whether they are explosive or anything can happen. So they are waiting for the place to be cleaned first, and his personal security also, because this army is kind of fragmented. So they were waiting for these economic forces to come, and whenever they give green light for him to come over, he will leave Senegal for Gambia.
Gambian journalist Omar Wali on the line from Banjul.
We asked our followers on Facebook what they thought of the role of ECOWAS in the recent developments in the Gambia. And Anas Awudu Sabongida from Ghana said that that means that West Africans have finally made the whole bloc democratic, as Jammeh happened to be the last leader who seized power through a coup. And Sani Sawane from Gambia said that Jammeh ran away with state property and several million dollars, and now he just wants to blame the next government. So there's been a lot of discussion on the Gambia happening on our Facebook page.
Thanks, Ole. I think we're going to come back to that later. But now, US President Donald Trump has been in office for just 3 days, and he's wasted no time getting down to business. He started by axing a major international trade deal, that's the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact, or TPP, and he's made it illegal for the US to fund international organizations offering abortion services. That's a move that health experts say will put many women and girls' lives at risk. Rebecca Reuters has more.
We just officially terminated TPP.
President Trump began his first full week in office by dismantling a major trade deal with Asia. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement between the US and 11 other Pacific Rim nations is aimed at lowering trade barriers. It was a key part of former President Barack Obama's Asia policy. Trump, who campaigned on a promise to withdraw the US from the deal, said it would be a great thing for American workers. On Monday, the president also signed an order banning funding for international organizations that offer or give information about abortions. Every year, tens of thousands of women around the world die from illegal abortions. Ulrike Neubert from the German-based Foundation for World Population warns that number could rise if access to safe terminations is not available.
We would have more, not illegal, but unsafe abortions, and they will go back into the underground, into the streets, where many more young women will in the end be dying.
The US is the single biggest donor to global health efforts. Thousands of international healthcare organizations now find themselves in the difficult position of deciding whether or not to continue family planning services.
DW's Rebecca Ritas with that report on Donald Trump's first actions as President of the United States. Now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has arrived in Mozambique on a three-nation African tour to promote trade. But Erdogan's mission goes beyond trade. He is asking African leaders to crack down on institutions linked to a Muslim cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who Erdogan accused of organizing a coup attempt against him last year. Erdogan arrived in the Mozambican capital, Maputo, from Tanzania, and he plans to visit Madagascar on Wednesday. Is this trip part of Turkey's effort to develop relationships in Africa? A question I put to Ufuk Tepebas, a Turkish PhD candidate at the Center for African Studies, the University of Basel in Switzerland.
We can take a Turkish president's current official visits from two perspectives. First of all, Turkey aims to upgrade its trade and commercial relations with the African countries because Africa is among target markets for Turkish enterprises. At the same time, Turkey is a member of the African Development Bank, and this membership provides more extensive opportunities for Turkish investors in the countries of the continent, especially in the field of construction. In addition to that, Africa also provides cheap raw materials for Turkish industry. Turkey also aims to diversify its trading partners throughout the continent. I think that Tanzania and Mozambique are suitable countries for this goal.
You talked about the construction aspect there. And in 2015, Turkish Airlines opened a route between Istanbul and Maputo. Now, to what extent has Turkey really penetrated the African market?
Africa is among target partners for Turkish enterprises, and for this reason, some Turkish officials and institutions are working to develop bilateral relations. And in this context, Turkish Airlines has more than 50 destinations in Africa.
Now, the Turkish government is seeking the closure or takeover of international institutions inspired by Fethullah Gulen, who Erdogan accuses of supporting last year's coup attempt. Can he really get his wish in Africa?
As you know, this organization has many educational institutions throughout the continent in Africa. In recent terms, some African countries such as Somalia and Gambia closed these schools. In this process, the Maarif Foundation wants to take over the schools that are linked to the Gulen movement. My personal opinion is that the Turkish government should follow a careful and patent strategy in this process and provide strong evidences and alternative solutions to persuade its African friends. Otherwise, some African countries may perceive this as an imposition, and this constitutes a risk in bilateral relationship.
Ufuk Tepebas, a Turkish PhD candidate at the Center for African Studies, the University of Basel, talking to me earlier about Turkish President Erdogan's visit in Africa.
Yeah, Abu, we have to take this moment to thank our followers on Facebook. We just passed 100,000 people who are following us.
And really?
Having only been there for a few months, I think that's an amazing number. And I have to really hand it out to our users and our followers.
Absolutely.
And they are part of the conversation and are really contributing a lot to our show.
Indeed, indeed. From me personally as well, a very big thank you to you. Keep the conversation going. We are always happy to have you on the other side.
And let's go back to our conversation about we were discussing before about the role of ECOWAS in the Gambia recently. I mean, they had a huge role. And Mbuwate Mukelabe, sorry, I'm just reading that name now, said that he is not so happy with his regional group, which is the SADC, which is the South African Development Community. And here we have seen people calling elections free and fair before people finish voting. Imagine that. And presidents congratulating one another because they are friends. So SADC is toothless. And then you have Anthony Sekumbi from Uganda says that he wishes that the African Union was like ECOWAS and could because most leaders don't want to empower the AU with standby forces to tackle African dictatorships. For example, in East Africa, where Museveni is still a major power in the region.
Thanks, Eloy. And thanks, everyone, as well, for your contributions. Keep the conversation going on our Facebook page, DW Africa. You are listening to DW's Africa Link from Bonn in Germany with me, Abubakar Jallo.
And me, Oli Tangen Jr.
And in the next 15 minutes, more gridlock in Cameroon as talks to end the nearly 2 months of protest in the country's English-speaking southwest hit a dead end.
And President Trump is one of the major topics that people are talking about on our Facebook page, especially his first few days in office.
Okay, off we go. In Cameroon, activities in the English-speaking southwest are still grounded after negotiations to end the almost 2 months of protest hit a dead end. The government of Cameroon failed to come to an agreement with striking trade unionists in order for schools and regional offices to reopen. The trade unionists are demanding for, among others, a federal state, one in which Cameroon's English speakers, who form nearly half of the population, have control over their school curriculum. So far, the school curriculum of the majority French population is being used in the English-speaking areas. School teachers complain this relegates English speakers to second-class citizens in the bilingual country. Moki Kinseka reports from Yaoundé.
Protests here in the northwest regional town of Jakiri are escalating. Hundreds of people are marching, singing that they will resist all attempts by their government to break with their values and their language. With 22 million of the population in Cameroon, the English-speaking people constitute only 20%. The leader of the English-speaking community, Wilba Joseph, vows to fight tooth and nail.
If this is what you show us after 55 years, then those who are saying that we should break Cameroon are right. They are correct. The people of West Cameroon cannot be your slaves. The people of West Cameroon are not. You did not conquer them in war. When the people will rise, even if you took the whole of the French army and added to yours, you will never bring them down.
The strike began 2 months ago with lawyers complaining of the overbearing influence of French language in all aspects of life. They wondered why French-speaking judges who do not understand English were transferred to courts in their regions. Teachers have joined the lawyers. Schools and universities have now been closed. Some pressure groups came in asking for a federal state to be created and others asking for outright secession. The government in reaction have arrested their leaders and shut media outlets that supported the strike. Communication Minister Issa Chiruma says the protesters will face the wrath of law.
These troublemakers will be held liable, accountable for their acts when time comes. The head of state has affirmed without any ambiguity that unitary form of the state is intangible and Cameroon is one and indivisible and shall so remain. There will therefore be no federalism, no secession.
Despite the minister's strong statement against the English-speaking Cameroonians, the protesters are determined to keep on fighting for their rights. Barrister Ben Muna is their lawyer.
The president of this country better wake up to the real fact. This country was united by a plebiscite. It was united by the will of the people of the Southern Cameroon, not by the will of any other person. The better fight, man. The better bloody fight. No liberties gained by lying down and allowing people to walk on you. Let them lose 1 year of school and get a better future. What are you talking about? Let them lose 2 years and get a better future.
All negotiations between the government and protesters are at a standstill. Ghost towns are being observed every Monday and Tuesdays, and children in the French-speaking regions are at home while their peers of the French-speaking regions are attending classes.
DW's Moki Kinseka reporting from Yaoundé.
We asked our users on Facebook if they thought that there was room in Cameroon or in other countries for two official languages. And Darlene Musoro from Cameroon said that there could be if there is mutual respect, but that's not the case in Cameroon. The English-speaking are more like second-class citizens. And Sani Sawane from The Gambia said it'll benefit both people who speak English and French. If my country would have it, I would be grateful. And yeah, because in The Gambia, they obviously speak English and they could be two languages there. Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you.
Africa on the move.
In Western Uganda, Eric Kadura and his wife Rebecca never thought they would one day be running a passion fruit social farming business. But they discovered farming as a way to empower young girls who dropped out of high school. Uganda is among the African countries with the highest rate of farm school dropouts. Eric and Rebecca hoped that by training these girls as commercial farmers, they would have a new start in life. This report by Hosea Jemba and Katia von Eisenhardt wrote is now presented by Zipporah Nyambura.
After doing some research, Eric Kaduru found out that there was almost no commercial farming in his country, but plenty of land available. 4 years later, he has proved that farming can be a profitable business and benefit rural communities on top.
We're creating social change. We're having people view agriculture as not just a chore or like, you know, that subsistence farming. They're starting to look at it as a business. So aside from teaching girls life skills, entrepreneurship, financial literacy, they're looking at different ways that they can view agriculture, which is a simple thing to get into if you own a small piece of land, as a business.
Ugandan farmers mostly grow crops to feed themselves and their families. It is a woman's job. As prestigious occupations go, it doesn't feature very highly. The girls, trained by the Social Enterprise Card Africa, are school dropouts. They are getting a rare second chance at being independent and providing for themselves. Among them is Kengisa Enete. Prior to joining Card Africa, she earned only $3 per month. Now she earns up to $50.
I am saving in a savings group. The other girls and I still share the money as a group. But when I get my portion of the money, I hope to start my own business. I want to do farming or perhaps dip my foot into various businesses or try retail trading to support myself.
Once trained, the women grow passion fruit on land leased by Kaduru from a church. Being a fair trader, he buys their crops at market prices and then distributes and sells them. After only 4 years, over 50% of Card Africa's income is self-generated. The rest of the operation is financed by local donors. 1,700 girls have gone through the program, Kaduru says, but he still has to overcome the social stigma attached to farming, which is seen locally as an occupation fit only for peasants.
When you look at the reality of the situation, everyone has to eat. So if you're the farmer providing the food, you will be supplying the people. So changing the mentality of people in rural areas to view farming as a business and not as a chore is still our biggest challenge.
A challenge well worth taking up. Western Uganda has about 90 million hectares of arable land, but fruit and vegetables are grown in less than 1% of that area.
And that report was by Hosea Jemba and Katia von Eisenhardt Rote, presented by Zipporah Nyambura.
Focus Europe.
France is Western Europe's top exporter of jihadists. That's, however, changing, but maybe not too fast enough. The French government has been very slow to create programs to fight the powerful law of radical Islam. With the Islamic State weakened in Iraq and Syria, European fighters are heading back home, and that poses a growing threat across the region. The homegrown attacks in France over the past 2 years are a case in point. Now, from the city of Bordeaux, Lisa Bryant takes a look at a new effort to turn the tide and just what role that Muslim religion should play.
In an inconspicuous building near the city center, an experiment is underway to bring at-risk youth back from the edge. A team of psychologists, legal experts, and imams are working with families and youngsters drawn to radical Islam. Imam Fuad Sanadi is Secretary General of Baldo's local Muslim Federation and a member of the CAPRI prevention program.
Our role is to offer critical thinking and a serene approach to religion that's not conflictual or linked to identity issues.
Now a year old, CAPRI offers an interdisciplinary approach to fighting radical Islam. Roughly 40% of the youngsters on its caseload are women. Many are converts. The average age is 22. CAPRI is unusual because it's a partnership between Baldo's Muslim leadership and the local government in a country where mosque and state don't always get along. At Baldo's City Hall, Deputy Mayor Marik Fetou, who's also CAPRI's spokesperson, says that partnership is its strength.
Vis-à-vis des familles et des jeunes, incontestablement.
For the youngsters and their families, the fact we're doing this program with the Muslim community is positive. It shows we're not confounding Islam and radicalization. And often, the Muslim scholars will create links between families and CAPRI.
If CAPRI's method works, some believe it could be a model for other French cities in a country that's a relative newcomer to de-radicalization programs.
France is belated, compared to the others.
Paris-based sociologist Farhad Kosurkovar is an expert on radical Islam.
Take, for instance, Great Britain. Prevent is many years old. Danish people began a few years ago. In Norway, they began de-radicalization processes at least 20 years ago with neo-Nazi people and so on.
Maman, t'es où?
Je suis là, ma chérie.
Je vais voir les filles.
Okay, ça marche.
But now, after the attacks in Nice and Paris, this country is searching for solutions. The state recently launched a new publicity campaign called Toujours le choix, or Always a Choice, to fight terrorist propaganda on the internet.
Personne ne me comprend, j'ai l'impression qu'il n'y a que toi. Oui, tu sais, l'islam, ça m'a beaucoup aidé, ça m'a fait comprendre plein de trucs.
This advert shows how an ordinary teenage girl called Emma develops an online relationship with a jihadi recruiter, the way many young French women have become radicalized. This fall, several were accused of plotting a car bomb attack in Paris. French authorities have also earmarked 300 million euros over 3 years to fight radicalization, including setting up more than a dozen de-radicalization centers around the country. A number of private initiatives are also mushrooming, some with dubious credentials.
Lisa Bryant reporting from Bordeaux in France. Oli, I understand we've had lots of responses from Africa, from our Africa audience on our Facebook page, DW Africa, with regards to Donald Trump.
Yeah, obviously, since his inauguration on Friday, people all around the world on social media have been discussing his upcoming presidency. There's a lot of questions, and I think people are, at least on our Facebook page, are saying we need to step back and give the guy a chance. So Opoka Kenneth wrote from Uganda, if you don't like Trump, don't hate him. Give him a chance to deliver what he has been promising. And Didam Musagoni from Nigeria said he can only engage with Africa if America will gain from it. So that's, again, this whole idea of America first. And Achimapong Kofi from Ghana wrote, Africa must engage itself. We should not be so dependent on other people. And we just want to take this time to thank all of you, our users on Facebook, because we just passed 100,000 users
absolutely,
on our page,
absolutely.
Which is a great, great number. We want to continue engaging with all of you as much as possible in the coming months and years. So go to facebook.com. /DW.Africa and follow us and engage with us and comment on our links and we might feature you on the air.
And from me as well, a very big thank you to all of you. Congratulations as well and keep the conversation going. And that's all we have time for. For more stories, visit our website, DW.com/Africa.
And I'm Uli Tangen, and I will continue to be following everything on social media.
From me, Abubakar Jallo, have a wonderful day.